Hey, this is Lawrence with a quick introduction. This is the first episode of a Bad Time Radio sideshow I'm launching with Dr. Claude Myron-Guzer. It's called Adapt or Die, and it's an exploration of various ways that old-time radio folds, warps, and mutilates classic literature as it's attempting to adapt it. For each episode, we will read a short story, then watch a film or television adaptation of that story, and finally listen to an OTR version of it. We kind of backed into this format by accident on this episode, but we will be sticking to it going forward. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. My name is Lawrence Allen.
Hi, this is Claude Myron-Guzer from the Cannonball Podcast.
And this is Adapt or Die, a Bad Time Radio sideshow. Welcome to this, a bonus episode of Bad Time Radio. It's just me and our friend Claude, and I thought I would kind of try to mix this up because, well, this one episode, I don't know if it would have made a good thing in the main feed, but on the other hand, Claude had I believe will have a lot of interesting things to say about it, and I will attempt to say the stupidest shit imaginable to kind of liven shit up, and hopefully together it will produce an episode. So we are discussing the CBS Radio Mystery Theater episode, The Mask of the Red Death, which aired first on January 10th, 1975. And I'm going to give a little bit of background on the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. And then Claude has actually gone in and reread The Mask of the Red Death. And if I know, Claude also read like 30 papers on it. So then he's going to summarize that. And then we will sort of discuss the way the episode attempts and fails to adapt it.
Okay. So I guess you're giving the game away like right up front.
I mean, this episode, I understand every like most of the decisions they made except for one, and even the one I kind of get, but it is still a baffling way of approaching trying to adapt this. So anyways, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater started in 1974. We've talked about it a couple of times, but I don't know if I ever like sat down and really gave like the full summary on it, so I'm going to do it here. That's about a decade after the form had died off in America. It was kicked off by Hyman Brown, who was a big wig old-time radio producer in like the 30s through the 50s. And it ran until 1982, producing 1,399 episodes, which is a crazy amount. It has E.G. Marshall as a host. He is almost never in the actual episode, but he will contribute sort of bumpers to it, which occasionally they set the scene, but often he just sort of repeats something that someone else said or something that anyone who has been paying attention will have noticed. It's also the, on the other hand, he's a very welcome presence because E.G. Marshall was a hell of an actor, and I don't begrudge them being like, hey, what if we found a very easy job for him to have that gave him some amount of money? The other thing about it that I think is interesting is that it had an insane production schedule. They would meet up in the morning, dole out parts, and have the thing recorded by noon. Actors got paid about $74, and the writers were paid $350. Because of that, it has incredibly variable quality. There aren't that many that I'm confident pointing to as like actual classics. I like Prisoner of the Machine, which has John Lithgow getting put in a concentration camp by robots, which is pretty fun.
No shit.
Yeah. And there's also one that has Sarah Jessica Parker, and it's like her first acting gig.
Oh my God.
But mostly it's sort of dreck. But on the other hand, because of the extremely like rushed production quality or schedule, you also get that thing you sometimes get with like old like horror movies from the 70s where they're just sort of like, well, we got to get it out the door. We don't have time to QC it. So you sort of end up with like a subconscious dump of whatever the writer's like obsessions were, which means that they are... I mean, they're very, like I said, I'm not going to ever say that this is like a good series. It is frequently a strange and fascinating series, though.
Yeah, this is weird. Okay, so what you just told me puts a lot of stuff into perspective. Okay, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but there's something I kind of admire about that kind of production schedule. I mean, that is nuts. I can't imagine just the logistics of... Write scripts, jump in, jump out, boom, boom, boom. Here's your 45 minutes, we're done. You know,
yeah.
That's astounding.
Now, a lot of the people they were hiring were actually people from the first old-time radio boom, you know, from like the 30s through the 50s. So they were old pros and could do this kind of thing in their sleep. But still, I don't think that it was quite, this is the only take we get, because they generally don't have like flubs in them, and there would occasionally be one. But
right.
Still, like, it's crazy that they're like, okay, we've got two takes to get this thing that's going to be on the radio probably in a week, you know?
So it's not so much Ed Wood as it's Roger Corman.
Yeah, and I that's a very apt analogy, because also they're extremely weird, but there's a sort of weird sheen of professionalism over all of them, which Corman's stuff always has too.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so Corman's dog died, we'll just use it for a prop, but man, it's a hell of a prop, right? Like one of those things.
And also, we're going to talk about Roger Corman a little bit later, because I actually went in and reviewed my notes on the Mask of the Red Death adaptation that he did, and I think it's an interesting contrast to how they did this adaptation, because that one largely works, and this one does not.
Oh my god, I've never seen that. I can't wait. Okay, so let's jump in.
Yeah, so tell Claude, and I suspect you're going to be done in like 3 minutes, what happens in the original short story, The Mask of the Red Death?
So a bunch of guys hold themselves up in a castle and die. All right, now you do yours.
I mean, there's a little bit more to it than that.
All right, no, I'm being silly here, but it really is extraordinarily brief. I mean, I remember, for God knows for what reason, but we always would get Edgar Allan Poe stories in school. And I remember in elementary school, like they would give us a Poe story around Halloween time to read or to do. I think I read Mask of the Red Death like around the time I was in fifth or sixth grade. And I remember, you know, kind of being into Poe just as a kind of creepy figure. Not so much that I could understand any of what was going on in fifth or sixth grade, but yeah, just as kind of a figure, right?
I was like, most of his stories are weird psychosexual meditations on the fact that death makes him horny, which makes him singularly unsuitable for like middle schoolers. Although since he was writing the 1850s, he wasn't actually writing the weird fetish porn that he would be if he were alive today.
Yeah, you know, thank God that Reddit didn't exist for Poe. Though I do have to say, a lot of what he was writing was, it's not exactly hack work. But he was writing to get an audience. Like he was a magazine guy, and he had this amazing talent to get fired from one magazine for either showing up drunk or not showing up at all, and then get hired by another magazine where he could utilize his editorial abilities. He was a very good editor, and he had lots of good connections to a lot of writers and a lot of other, you know, figures. So he could get hired by another magazine and then turn the subscriptions around, like turn circulation around. And then he'd fall back into, like, you know, his old behaviors and get fired and then move on to another magazine. But what he was really good at was gauging the public taste. Like, he had some, what was it? It was some line of his, like, there's nothing more poetic than the death of a beautiful young woman. And I think sometimes that gets taken as him sort of saying, you know, I guess, how do I put this? That's the most tragic, you know, thing that you can have in this sort of misogynistic way. But what he seems in context to have been alluding to is the fact that it sold well. Sort of like, you know, the JonBenet Ramsey thing, the public gloms onto some kind of story about a cute murdered girl. And so a lot of the stuff that he wrote really was designed to attract that audience. But you're also right, death makes him horny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Mask of the Red Death is kind of a riff on the Decameron, Boccaccio's Decameron. Boccaccio wrote the Decameron sort of coming out of the plague in, I guess, the beginning of what we would call the Renaissance. Boccaccio was, I guess, a younger, somewhat contemporary of Dante, or sort of like a generation after Dante. And the Decameron is a series of interlocked short stories, more or less. But the frame narrative for the Decameron is that a bunch of noblemen have taken themselves out of the city in the middle of the plague and hold themselves up in this castle, and they get bored, so they start telling each other stories. And so everybody has to tell 10 stories or something like that. I can't remember the math on the whole thing. But everybody tells stories, and the stories interweave and comment on each other in this kind of like Chaucerian Canterbury Tales sort of way. But the running thing is that they're this embrace of life in the midst of death, that despite the death raging on around them, despite the mortality around them, there's this embrace of you know, the joys and pleasures of living as much as you can in the middle of this environment. It never quite forgets that death is raging all around, but it tries to find joy where it can. It's sort of like if you ever watched Seventh Seal. Have you seen that one?
No. My Ingmar Bergman experience is attempting to watch The Virgin Spring once and then getting really bored and watching Last House on the Left instead. Which was a mistake, albeit I'm not sure how big of one.
Well, any attempt to watch Last House on the Left is it's harrowing. That's a scary movie. It's one of those movies. It's one of those horror movies where it's sort of like, you know, you just got to go and pray afterwards. Sort of like,
well, this is apropos of nothing, but so I was talking to my, you know how Last House on the Left, it's like half one of the most brutal horror movies ever made, and then half sub yeehaw redneck jokes.
Yes.
Yeah. So, which means that, like, at least most of the review websites that I like frequent will call it a failure because it doesn't do the thing a horror movie is supposed to do, which is, you know, have a mood that it sustains throughout the film, right? Because every time it gets any tension going, they're like, ha ha, the deputies have to stow away on a chicken truck, and the woman who rides it is a black woman who speaks with a probably racist accent and is missing half her teeth. It's like, but I mean, we were just in a rape scene. What the shit? My father had seen that movie, and when he was describing it to me, he highlighted the deputies as the most upsetting thing about it, because it's like the law enforcement in it is so utterly unequal to the task before them.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, and that kind of goes along with where Craven was at, you know?
Yeah. Anyways, sorry.
All right, so let's get back to The Mask of the Red Death.
So, as opposed to me telling you what my dad thought of a horror movie from before I was born.
See, now I'm really, really interested. All right, but anyway, Mask of the Red Death, so it's a riff on the Decameron. It's sort of taking that frame story as its basis and turning it into a moral story. So Prince Prospero, in the time of plague, takes all of his followers and buddies and cronies to a mansion in the middle of nowhere. It's like a giant abbey, a castle, and holds themselves up and gets provisions for months and months and months in order to sort of ride out the plague. The first paragraph is just a description of the plague, which causes you to just bleed out everywhere. And so the prince is happy regardless. Now, Prospero is, you know, it's one of those quintessential ironic Poe names. Where you don't have to try too hard to unpack the irony. Prospero hinting at prosperity, but it's also, you know, I wonder if he had this lurking in the background. It's also the name of the wizard in The Tempest. And the whole thing about the Tempest is, you know, Prospero, the wizard, the enchanter, is he's banished or exiled to this island in the Caribbean, where he uses his magic to sort of get his own revenge. He creates a bunch of illusions to create this shipwreck where the king and the brother who had him exiled can sort of come together and find him, and he can sort of like show that his brother was really the bad guy, and he gets forgiveness, and everything is sort of settled at the end. I don't know if Poe was sort of drawing on that, or maybe he just was inspired by the name or something. I'm not really quite sure. But anyway, Prospero takes all his followers to this private estate. And after 6 months, they're all kind of bored. So he has a giant ball, and it's described as, you know, sort of the height of decadence. And I guess it would be if it's, you know, this pleasure ball in the middle of a plague that's turning around, killing everyone. There's this.
One thing I didn't read the whole story, but I did glance over it. One thing that sort of struck me when I was reading through that little bit of it was that the ball is largely sexless. And I think it's sort of the thing where he really wanted to write it is an orgy, but either the standards of the time or his own psychology wouldn't let him do so.
Yeah, I think it was probably the standards, because there are some suggestions that make it sound like an orgy. It really does, right? The I don't know. He had directed in great part the movable embellishments of the Seven Chambers upon occasion of this great fete, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. Be sure they were grotesque. There was much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm, much of what has been seen since seen in Hernani. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madman fashions. There were much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. It seems like in that mixing of enticing and disgusting, he's got something of the erotic lurking underneath, or at least he's hinting at it. Enough so that it begins to get lurid. I think to draw an audience, use your imagination to think about, you know, what this is. It seems to be sort of teasing in a way.
So he's going like, hey, guys, if I tell you about an orgy, this is going to get banned and I'm going to get run out of town. But here's some adjectives. Maybe you could think of the orgy.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. I honestly do. Because a lot of times in Poe, he's also sort of picking up the style of the Penny Dreadful and some of the other like really nasty stuff that was going on. Like, side note, if you really want to read lurid, nasty tales, then check out temperance novels from the 19th century. Because, you know, those were the books that were ostensibly written to persuade people not to drink. And how do you persuade people not to drink? Well, they're kind of like the Lifetime movies of the 19th century. Like, you get to watch people go through all sorts of horrible punishments and end up destitute prostituting themselves. And there's lots of lurid descriptions of the prostitution and whatnot. And so it's all in the guise of a moralistic tale, but it's just nasty. Anyway, side note. So you've got a whole bunch of rooms, each in a different color. And that's what's kind of fascinating about this narrative. It's narrated at you or to you. You don't really have characters. You only have one person really named, and that's Prospero. But he's not even really a character. He's just kind of like a name, right? He's just this thing that does these things and is not really active throughout the thing. It's not like there's a full psychology here. It reminded me of like Borges or something, because it's just like this weird telling of a series of rooms. In fact, a lot of this is taken up with interior design. There are these rooms, each one is a specific color until you get to the last one where it's all black with these red windows. And it's reminiscent of the Red Death and dying. And then there's this ominous clock that can make everyone stop and stand still. It literally makes the music drop with its terrifying bong. It gongs on every hour. And every time they hear it, the music stops and everyone stops dead still. So it's described as the height of decadence. This is sort of like what you were talking about before. So they have this gigantic ball, and at midnight, they're scared of the bongs, and the crowd sees someone new that they don't recognize. It's a giant hooded masked figure in red, and it scares everyone because it seems to be like this weird red figure that's reminiscent of the plague that's going around. It walks into the hallway of the colored rooms. Prospero and everyone else goes to chase him, and they follow him into the blood room. Everybody sort of lurches at him, grabs him, and there's nothing underneath his clothes. He's the embodiment of the plague, and then everybody dies of plague.
Does Prospero stab him at the end?
It's kind of uncertain. Tries to. Okay, there was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which instantly fell afterwards, fell prostrate in death, the Prince Prospero. Then summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements, a corpse-like mask, which they had handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. They take his clothes off, they take the mask off, there's nothing there.
Yeah. And then there's a famous last line. You might as well read it, I suppose.
And now is acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night. One by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. and the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the red death held illimitable dominion over all. The end.
Yeah. So, sorry.
That's it.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
So, I mean, the summary we just, or you just gave, I would suspect, let me check the timestamps, maybe 10 minutes, right? Give or take. Mm-hmm. I suspect that if you were to have actually read the thing out loud, it would have taken you maybe 15 total.
Yeah. I've got an audiobook version of it that's about 15 minutes.
Yeah. So this, you know, it's a classic short story. I think it's kind of debatable whether it actually counts as a short story. It seems more like a fable or an anecdote, frankly, because it doesn't have, it's sort of just a bunch of stuff happens. But yeah. I mean, it's well written. It's pretty spooky. You know, it's, there's a reason it keeps getting assigned to people and people keep like studying it and trying to adapt it and stuff. Right.
Yeah. It's got a couple things going for it. It is evocative. I mean, it's a mood piece. It doesn't really have any depth psychology. You can't really chart this. You know, when I teach my intro to lit courses, I try to break down the classical realist short story as one more genre. And it always begins, whether you're reading Chekhov or Jumbo Lahiri, it always begins a meteor race. There's a flashback to a before time, which fills in the gaps of what's going on and moves back forwards into the present, where you have basically the unfolding action. You have the rise, the climax, where a character learns something or understands something or comes to some kind of sudden realization. And then you have the suggestion of a fallout, you know, from that.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen. And,
yeah. Which, so having paid some, you know, some obeisance to the classic and gotten some analysis of it from Claude, I can think of very few things that would be harder to adapt than this. There's just enough there that I can understand why people want to try, because that final image of you pull it back, there's no one there, oh shit, the plague, then you all die, that's pretty cool. And the whole, like, the design, set dressing is pretty evocative. But, I mean, no characters, scarce any plot. And if you were to put it to screen, even if you really dwelled on going through all the... I mean, you could make it go longer by really dwelling on going through the rooms or playing up the orgying or something, but it's going to get really boring. And, you know, that's it. There have been a couple of different attempts to adapt this. There's a... And even some metatextual stuff. There's a John Langan short story called Technicolor that sort of... does the what if the Necronomicon was really had like secrets in it, but for Edgar Allan Poe, and has this as kind of a description of a summoning ritual, essentially, which is pretty good.
Wow.
There have, but and then for our purposes, there the most successful adaptation is the Roger Corman movie from the 60s. The way they approach adapting this is essentially, you said that you thought that this was like a sort of morality tale almost, right?
Yeah. Basically,
I think that that's, I mean, I haven't read it, so I can't like go toe to toe to you on that. It is at least to me debatable because, I mean, Prospero, I mean, he's not a good person because he walled himself up in the castle, but it also doesn't seem like he's uniquely wicked for a nobleman, especially for the period. So it's sort of just like, hey, you can't get away from death no matter what, is at least a reading you can do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But, sorry.
No, but that's what I was going to say. That's what I mean by morality tale. That there's something it kind of takes Decameron, the Boccaccio's Decameron, and flips it on itself, where it's like, how dare you, you know, try to find happiness in life? There's nothing but death. There's nothing but plague. It's weird because, all right, this is what I meant. The story itself is kind of nebulous as to what it means. It's playing up the decadence of, you know, this seeming orgy in the castle. That's the kind of affront, I think. But you can apply this in a lot of different ways. It's so nebulous that you could apply it to all kinds of attempts to evade reality or evade truth or evade, you know, whatnot, and do the wrong thing when the right thing is so, you know, right in front of your face in some ways. Does that make sense?
So the right thing would just be to acknowledge the plague, essentially, even if you can't actually do anything about it?
I guess. Maybe, or try to help someone or do something. It seems to be a morality play. It's kind of puritanical in that it wants to punish pleasure, I think.
Fair. So if you're just like, well, fuck this orgying guy too. I mean, also fuck the peasants, but we're not talking about them.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's what I mean. That I think it's weirdly... It's unadaptable, but weirdly adaptable in that the moral could fit a couple of different things, you know?
Yeah.
Then how do you act this out? Because there are no characters and there's no plot.
Yeah. So what the most successful adaptation I know of did was essentially they make Prospero an out-and-out, like, Gil de Rais-style Satanist, right?
All right.
And he's, like, an absolute asshole to all the peasants. He takes in a young peasant woman and her husband, or her betrothed, and attempts to debauch her. He's constantly torturing people. They still can't show orgies because it's the 1960s, but they're doing their best, you know? And then they also, like, just throw in the short story Hop Frog, because why not, you know?
Just throw it in?
Yeah, like, it's a subplot in this movie.
Okay, I gotta see this now.
It's, I don't know if it's the best of the Poe adaptations, but the weird thing about the Poe adaptations was that they would save the sets from the previous ones. So as yeah. you get further and further in cycle, they get more and more elaborate. And I believe that this is the last one. So it is at least the prettiest Ooh. One to look at.
That beautiful garish Corman Technicolor.
Yeah. And then the other weird thing is that they explicitly make the Red Death in this a moral creature. Like it is explicitly coming to punish Prospero for his arrogance, and it explicitly spares the young peasant girl and her beloved because they're good people, which I don't, I saw it a while back, so I don't quite remember how they square that with the fact that it's also murdering the fuck out of every peasant it can lay hands to. But at the very least, the way, and it's weirdly personified, like the girl goes and, or one of the characters goes and talks to it and asks it for help. And then the ending is it going and it's like played by this awesome guy, like this character in an awesome like red garb that covers itself completely. It's sort of like, it's not quite a Grim Reaper, but it's sort of like Grim Reaper crossed with a monk almost. And then it's constantly dealing itself tarot decks, which is weird. Or tarot hands. And then the last scene is it's like gone in and killed all the bad people and spared a couple of good people. And then it goes off and there are other characters who are dressed exactly like it, except in different colors. So it's like the Red Death is going and hanging out with the Black Death and the Yellow Plague and all that. They're like going off to compare notes on the human murdering business or something.
The Red Death, the Black Death, and Yellow Journalism all meet up at a bar. Is that sort of how it works?
Yeah. And it's successful partially because it's got Vincent Price's thing. Or yeah. He's the bad guy, so of course it's, you know, he's doing a great job. And partially because essentially they're like, okay, we've got this climax. Now we need to, that's like 5 minutes. The party is another five. We need to find, like, the rest of the movie is just Vincent Price being an asshole and, you know, trying to convert this woman to Satanism and stuff. And I think that that's sort of like the natural way of adapting it. This one does something really, really weird and different than that.
Like, yes, it does.
Among other things, as we'll get to, it ditches, I would argue, 95% of the story, which is the description of the rooms.
Yeah, it gets rid of that in favor of this weird sort of
overheated melodrama, which is the CBS Radio Mystery Theater's, you know, sort of raison d'etre as much as it had one.
Okay, I was going to ask, is that sort of like, I guess, a part and parcel of what they did?
Well, what they do is incredibly varied because what they did was put on basically any script that they could air on the radio and that the person would take $350 for. But okay, that is, if they have a thing that they do, it's that, and then sort of not low stakes, but kind of shitty crime stories, basically. Or if you reached into a bag of all their episodes and pulled something out, usually that's what you'd get. So
okay, I got you.
Anyways, so I'm going to go ahead and start summarizing the CBS Radio Mystery Theater one. I'm hoping we'll get through this one kind of quick because despite the fact that it's 44 minutes long, there's just not a lot of meat on the bone. Oh, wait, before that, though, Claude, would you recommend people seek out this episode of the CBS? Or would you recommend people seek out The Mask of the Red Death, the short story?
Yeah, the short story is fascinating and weird. Read it in context of, I think Poe works better when you read a handful of his short stories all together, and you start to notice like these tendencies, and you can really sort of extrapolate on the tendencies. Like the thing that I noticed, I read this in a handful of others, and the thing that I noticed is his intense focus on sensation. It's almost like sensation is horror itself. And that was kind of weirdly fascinating to me because I'm really more interested in how the 19th century French symbolists interpreted Poe. And because that plays into how modernism developed, which is kind of like my field. Poe in and of himself isn't like my absolute favorite, but the stories, like, read Mask of the Red Death and read it alongside Pit and the Pendulum and read it alongside maybe like Telltale Heart and
Are you gonna throw the Black Cat in there, which I think
that really is like one of the most gruesome and creepy and weird necrophiliac things he's got going. But yeah, it's you know, it's definitely worth checking out. It's definitely worth seeking out if you're an adult and you're not in fifth grade.
Yeah, and I haven't read it in a long time, but I'm going to say you might as well check it out, too, because how many classics of world literature can you knock off in, like, 15 minutes? Go ahead, get a little culture in your life. It's fine. And, okay, as for the episode of CBS Radio Mystery Theater, without spoilers, would you recommend it?
If you know the Poe story, it's a little on the long side. It's got some things that are, like, that are so truly bizarre, you're like, why the hell are they doing that? That are sort of jaw-droppingly strange. So kind of as a lark, if you got 45 minutes to spare, like doing the dishes or something like that, and you've got it on audio, it's worth kind of listening to just for the what the fuck factor.
Yeah. I'm going to say it. Sorry.
No, but as far as a creepy story goes, nah, not really.
Yeah, so for me, it is a failure as a horror story. I would recommend listening to it, especially at like 1.2, 1.3 speed, because it's pretty pokey. And that really will help with that. It is such a strange way of going about adapting this short story, to the point where if you just removed the name, you could remove the name from it and change the name of the disease, and you would not know that this is an adaptation. You'd think it was like a light homage or something. It's really right. Weird. It does have, I think, a very funny twist to it. So if you're like interested, you should check it out before you listen to the rest of this. It's a bit of a thinker twist. It's not as immediately arresting as, you know, suddenly the devil or Gorilla Pilot or some of the other twists we have done, but it is, once you think it through, you're like, wait, what? Like, a bunch on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, man.
I don't have anything to say. It's just a hell of a twist.
Yeah. So, anyways, I will go ahead and start. So, this is set in the future, which is the first of the many strange decisions. The thing with this aired in the 70s, and this takes place in 1996, 21 years in the future. It also takes place in a future where apparently farming no longer exists, which raises a lot of questions that they never really answer. And we find ourselves in the mansion of one Milo Manderson, which, you're adapting one of the great, like, tales of, like, aesthetic decadent literature. So, of course, you gotta give people... Milo fucking Manderson, perhaps the most a name that thinks mayonnaise is too spicy and that can never be taken seriously.
We go from Prince Prospero to Milo Manderson, like that was in my notes. It's such a like a weird decision, and what is, you know, my question was, what are they trying to conjure up with that name? Right,
it seems like he's supposed to be some kind of like 1950s self-made titan of industry, almost Ayn Rand-esque figure, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this thing is trying to be about class, although, well, I guess it sort of is. It's debatable whether it succeeds. It does come down pretty strongly on the side of rich people or shit. At
least. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't really succeed, but anyway.
Yeah. So we are on his mansion. The Red Death is ravaging the countryside. It has started in America, and over the course of the story, will spread to the rest of the world. The other characters we meet right away is Jack, and who is, well, first there's Doreen, who is Milo Manderson's daughter, so Doreen Manderson. Then there is Jack, who is her husband. And then there is Floss, who is Milo Manderson's trophy fiancé.
Sounds like a gun mall. It's crazy.
There is a pretty good chance that they didn't tell us who played what, but a lot of the people in this were actually like stars of gangster movies from the 30s who transitioned to radio stars in the 40s and 50s and then revived on this. So there's a pretty good chance it is someone who cut her teeth playing a gun mall. Interestingly, one of the most prolific writers for the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, friend of the show Elspeth Eric, was famous for playing gun malls before she's just like, what if I started cranking out weird psychosexual nightmare scripts for the CBS Radio Mystery Theater?
Oh, wow. Because, like, Floss and Jack both sounded really out of place.
Yeah, especially Jack is supposed to be like this young, vibrant, almost not quite hippie-ish because it's 1996, but a guy who's going to change the world with organic farming. And he sounds like the squarest businessman your dad ever worked with.
Yeah, it's like there was a little bit of I could hear a little bit of like Brooklyn back there or something like that. I mean, it was really weird, and he's just kind of sounds really put upon. You know, if we could just get organic farming off the ground, you know, just a little, you know, man, just regretful and put upon. But he's supposed to be our hero, more or less, right?
Yeah. Him and Floss. Floss, I think, I actually quite liked Floss, like, listening through. So anyways, they are preparing to hole up in Milo's massive mansion on Lookout Mountain, because, you know, why spend time thinking of a name? It's fine. You're not getting paid that much, so just move on. Come on. So they are... Jack really doesn't want to stay because he wants to go try to help people with the Red Death. It's unclear if he actually has that ability or not. As Milo reminds us repeatedly, Jack is just a farmer. For some reason, Milo hates farmers. He can't believe that there are still farmers anywhere. And he keeps calling Milo a hayseed because this was probably written by someone who was born in about 1910.
Yeah, some of the diction was a little off. I was going to ask
you that. We didn't get this in this one, but whenever this show tries to write really young people in the modern era, it fucks up so bad. Because the person who's writing it will inevitably have come up at a time where, you know, their idea of a young person ended up being a beatnik, essentially. Oh, wow. And then they will be trying to filter that through slang that they have heard on TV in the 60s and 70s, and it does not go well.
So that actually shed some light on Jack, like why he talks the way he does, why he sort of acts the way he does. He made no sense. Like I was sort of expecting if he's going to be like this organic farmer type dude, he'd be sort of like the hippie character. But you know what? There's a shade of beatnik back there.
You know, I've listened to so many of these that Jack didn't actually read as that weird to me. I guess I've just broken my brain in a small but key way.
Your brain is so broken that you can't recognize the beatnik when he's staring right at you, drinking his espresso and rubbing his goatee.
And communicating to me in an incomprehensible patois of man's and rhythmic drumming. Anyways. Jack is, he wants to go down the mountain to help the village. And Milo goes,
who's going to help by farming?
Or I guess he's just, this is sort of, it gets a little bit interesting when you compare it to Prince Prospero, because it's sort of like, what could Prince Prospero have actually done to help people? What the fuck could Jack actually do? He has a plan for saving the world after the plague is gone, but he has no idea, like, he's not a fucking doctor.
I don't know, maybe his corn can help. Maybe there's a tomato that can create the antidote to, I don't know, but you're absolutely right. It's a strange part of the plot.
Yeah, but so anyways, he wants to go down the mountain. So of course, Milo Manderson produces a gun and says, "You're not going anywhere, buddy. I want you to stay here with Doreen because you make her happy," which the rest of the script does not really bear out particularly, but whatever.
That's such a weird move, too. It's like, you're going to stay here or I'm going to shoot you.
Milo Manderson, we later find out, is, you know, he's a little bit old. He's worried about aging. He's kind of not all there mentally, right?
I suppose.
I read him a lot as Frank from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And like Frank, he is constantly pulling out a gun.
See, I thought they were trying to be as serious as they could be about this. And I don't know. It just, the action seemed inexplicable to me.
Yeah.
It seems so weird. But I guess if he's a somewhat demented Danny DeVito, then a ton of shit just clicks right into place.
So Jack reluctantly decides that it's probably better to not get shot and die of the plague than to get shot and then possibly die of the plague later. So he agrees to stay. And then a helicopter approaches. And on the helicopter are Nils and Magda. Magda is, for no particular reason, a deaf-mute woman. I legit think they might have done that just because it saved them paying an actress. And Nils is an incredibly hot... He's got he's like 6'5", long blonde hair, looks like a Viking apparently, and he's got an accent that you said read like a Syrian Jew, but I thought the fact that he's named Nils might mean they're trying to make him like Swedish or somewhere from the northern country, because that is actually a name you get up there.
Well, no, it was Jack. Jack reminded me, like, his voice reminded me of my boss.
Shit, I totally misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay,
dude.
Yeah, no. Like, his voice sounded kind of like my wife's old boss. And he was from the Syrian Jewish community, also from Brooklyn. And, like, it just sounded kind of, like, weirdly jarring. I can't imagine her old boss, you know, talking about organic farming. That's what made it so weird. No, but Nils, like, that's the other weird thing. So they invite this guy. And Nils' voice is so weird because it's kind of like creepy old man. Or I was reading it as, like, creepy old man.
Yeah, it definitely does not sound like an incredibly hot strapping. It sounds like,
right?
It sounds kind of like a vampire when it's trying not to like make you think it's a vampire.
Yeah.
Before it's like, nah, I got you under my spell, so now I'm really going to let this accent rip. But before, when he's like trying to buy Carfax Abbey, this is probably how Dracula talked.
Right. So anyway, he brings his wife, who seems about right. They don't have to cast anyone for it, so why not make her a deaf mute, right?
Yeah, and they come inside. Milo, in a plot development, or in a statement that will later raise an enormous number of questions, says that he has sent them to every single doctor he could lay hands on to make sure they didn't have the Red Death. And so they're going to come take care of them while they're holed up in the mansion until the Red Death is passed. He's larded it up with food and water and everything. The helicopter pilot would also like to come inside, but Milo waves him off essentially with his gun.
Yeah, he hasn't been vetted.
Yeah, which this phrase, I mean, we lived through the pandemic, so we've thought about these things a great deal more. But
yeah.
It is very strange to think that apparently... He didn't put together the pieces of, well, this was going to be a long helicopter ride in an enclosed space. I don't also need to make sure that the helicopter pilot doesn't have this, even if I'm not going to let him in, because otherwise he will give it to them.
What kind of titan of industry has no idea about logistics whatsoever? It blows my mind. But then again, CEOs are often not the brightest people. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and also this takes place in 1996, so presumably there should have been some kind of advances in pathology or whatever since the 70s. I don't know, it's an odd choice, and the script doesn't really seem to have thought through the logic of, like, how bubbles and shit work, or are supposed to work in pandemics.
Right.
So anyways, Then we cut to 1 week later. Jack is sitting looking out a window and notes that a lot of the lights in the village down below are out. Flossie comes up and talks to him, and he notes that, or she says, well, the lights, maybe the people aren't home. And Jack says, no, the lights have burned out. Because apparently in the year 1996, if you leave a light on for a week, it will burn out, which, I mean, I guess I don't remember what lights were like in the 90s, and I don't know what they were like in the 70s. That is definitely not true now, though. So apparently they just had shitty light bulbs back then. And they talk for a little bit, and Flossie makes this crazy crap, this very strange comment that I have noted down. I believe she is talking about the size of her boobs and her butt, because she says, up here in the head, nothing. Down here and here, plenty. I don't know how else to interpret that.
Yeah, that was a little odd. That was one of those moments where sort of like, yeah, I guess. Like, I don't know. It was one of the things that I was thinking about was how much can you reveal or how do you convey information in a radio show? That really sort of came up at the very end.
Yeah. It's weird. Among other things, they don't actually have them comment. I thought they did the Milo draws a gun pretty well in the first scene, because instead of saying, oh my God, why'd you pull that gun? He's just like, what are you going to do with that gun? You can't, you know, murder me into staying.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't know how you make it apparent that a woman is hot without either a man being a creep or the woman saying something that, in my experience, a woman would not say.
Right. So...
because, I mean, I think my wife is quite attractive and has an ample figure, but she never comments on it. I may have to cut that. Whatever.
All right. Anyway.
Yeah, and then this is where we find out that Jack is super into organic farming. Flossie comments that calls it orgasmic farming at first. And he doesn't actually explain what organic farming is terribly well. He just says that it's a way of replenishing the soil.
It's a bit more than that, Jack.
Yeah, it's fine. I guess he's trying to explain it to Flossie or something. I don't know. And then he explains that he believes that the reason the plague is happening is because people aren't eating right and the soil is weak. So the food they consume isn't good. And then that's causing the plague. It's unclear.
He's an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, it's unclear if this is the result of like just general environmental degradation somehow causing plagues, or if he's literally saying like we're not eating right, so it's weakening our immune system. It's... weird.
It is odd, because at the very beginning in the intro, like in the intro bumper, they do sort of have this whole weird thing about environmentalism and pollution being a big problem, but you know, people are really going to step up and take care of that, you know, and there are some hopeful people who are fighting against apathy. So they do seem to frame it in the beginning as an ecological thing.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is unclear how eating non-GMO will help you avoid the plague? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the idea that trying to make the soil richer might make the plants you get out of them more nutritious might make some sense, but yeah, it's not like the ice caps are melting and it's unleashed a super plague because it was in the thawing ice or something. The causation is quite muddled, although it is apparent, as we find out, apparently he is 100% right. Which, yeah. Whatever. I would like to talk a little bit about Flossie. She is the only character in this I actually like. I think it's because she's good-natured. She has a realistic, I guess, sense of herself and her place in the world, which is kind of an interesting take to put on the character, you know?
Right. Because she could be just kind of a two-dimensional gun mall, but she... she knows why she's there and seems to show some depth of character. Like she tells Jack straight up that she's pretty much there to be Milo's mistress or whatever, and she's doing it for her own survival, right? So she's kind of self-aware about
sort of she refers to her relationship with Milo at one point as a kind of bargain. So it's not like she thinks he really loves him. She just knows that she's young and pretty and that he wants that. You know, it's an interesting take on a trophy wife character, and I'm sure it's other places, but this is the first time I've seen something like it. And I thought the actress playing her, whose name I cannot find, I can find the general cast list, but not who played what, did a pretty good job with her. And also she wasn't like egregiously voice cast or miscast. So that also helped.
Right.
And also Jack at the end of this says that it won't even matter when the play goes away because there's more coming.
Right, right.
And then they go to dinner and there's like a lot of black back and forth. Milo continues to be an asshole. Doreen also kind of is a jerk. And at the end of it, Milo says, "You should be more grateful to me for saving you, Flossie." And Flossie's like, "Saving me for what?" And then we get a newscast that the plague is going worldwide. Doreen and Flossie fight over Jack in a way that is not really justified by Jack, as near as I can tell. Milo starts to like say that Nils is, and his wife are doing a bad job of taking care of him, which I don't know. If you're going to be stuck in with someone for an indeterminate amount of time, maybe don't just be in it. And they're going to prepare all your meals and there's no police anymore. Maybe you shouldn't be a jerk to them. That's my right. note to Milo Manderson. And then, he also says that Magda has been cooking bad recently. And then Magda is coming out carrying coffee, and she keels over and starts bleeding from everywhere. And that's the end of Act 1. So, yeah, fun stuff, right?
A commercial break and stand up and jump around and, you know, get a stretch in, and then we're back.
Yeah, and you could listen to some vintage 70s advertisements if you found one of the ones with vintage 70s advertisements. I don't know. Anyways, and you can discover that instead the 1970s, instead of telling people to go to their website, they'd say write to this address for more information.
Oh, so quaint.
Yeah. So anyways, then we come back and Milo is trying to throw Magda outside, which is, of course, pointless at this point, of course, you know, because she's already exposed you guys. She was handling your food and stuff. I don't know what the transmission vector is on this thing, but unless it's literally sexual, you guys all have whatever she had. You know?
Right.
But anyways, he's like, I'm going to throw her outside because I don't want to get the red death. Nils is like, No, I'm not going to let my wife. And Milo, of course, does the Milo thing and pulls out his gun. So Magda signs that she's going to go outside to die because she doesn't want them to die with her, which, again, not how it works. And then she dies on the porch, and apparently they never think to clear her off because they keep commenting on how she's still there throughout the rest of this.
Yeah, it's a gruesome detail, and also inconsiderate, but I don't
Yeah. know. So then Nils begins to threaten Milo, says that he's going to die. Milo's like, "I don't like your threats," and Nils is like, "Well, it's a promise." There's a news report saying that people are fleeing the city, but the newscaster dies on air, which crazy. And then we cut back, or sorry, we've cut at this point a little bit, and then we cut to them all talking. Nils essentially says, "You know, I can say whatever I want to you at this point because you guys cannot take care of yourself." Flossie doesn't know how to cook, and Doreen apparently does but doesn't want to. Doreen really starts laying into Nils and saying that he's a bad servant. And Nils does not quite make the obvious rejoinder that he just watched his wife die like 2 days ago and can still see her rotting corpse whenever he walks around the house. And instead starts making fun of her for not knowing how to cook.
Right. Well, that gets to, I think, your observation that there is a kind of class critique in here somewhere, but it's a little absurd, right? Like, it's so broad. Who can't fix a sandwich?
Yeah.
And the fact that Doreen just doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Well, if anybody could cook, wouldn't it be Jack, the organic farmer?
Yeah, but Jack hates them all. I don't know, man. Also, Jack comments that he's not going to bother eating their food because it has no nutritive value, which kind of makes me wonder how he's still alive at this point, but whatever.
Yeah.
Or how they're alive, I suppose.
Are they literally just stuffing their faces with cake? Like, they're just eating, like, handful after handful of Hershey's Kisses or something?
I have no idea, man. So anyways, then Miles starts praising his daughter, which I think is the first time he's ever seemed like happy with her, because she was an asshole to his servant, which does make this whole thing kind of play out like Soviet propaganda about what capitalists are like. Jack starts complaining that Doreen is a bad person, which is totally fair, although it does raise the question of why he married her, because it doesn't seem like she's acting any different now than she was at the start of this before everything got really bad, you know?
Oh, yeah.
She's just, it's one of those, like, marriages that exists entirely to be destroyed because of narrative convenience, and because of that, they have to, you know, make the, well, at least one of the person a real shit, and in this case, they chose Doreen. Also at this point we find out that it's only been 9 days and that these people are still already going pretty crazy, which, I mean, I don't know about you, but I just survived a year and a half of quarantine and I'm staring down the barrel of another 6 months, depending on how Delta goes. So these people, you know, weaklings.
Yeah. That's what I kind of felt at the, at least Poe had them 6 months, 5 to 6 months before they really went nuts and needed an orgy.
Yeah, the other confusing thing is that there's no particular reason why they couldn't have just made the time jump longer. I guess initially they need the like scene where Magda dies to happen pretty quick, because otherwise it's like, where did she get the Red Death? But after that, I mean, make it go longer. Why not?
Yeah, unless they wanted to contract it to have her infection spread more quick. I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah. So let's see. Oh, then, at this point, Milo wants to go play bridge, but no one else is down for playing bridge. So he's going to go up to the solarium and Doreen is going to join him. And Flossie says she's going to stay there with Jack. And then, Doreen makes a joke about how, Flossie and Jack are going to have an orgy. And my sort of question was, I mean, how many people did you need to have an orgy in the 70s? Because nowadays it's more than two.
Well, you know what? Maybe it depends on not how many participants, but what kind of sex you're having.
So you're saying that any mouth stuff would have been so unheard of and mind-blowing in the 70s that they're just like, what orgy is this?
Or duration, like longer than 15 minutes or something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just thought it was amusing. And also, the fact that they straight up said the word orgy on the radio in the 70s was strange to me.
Well, you know, that was around the time that Deep Throat was, you know, in the theater, so
yeah,
the
but
public
I'm gonna,
was
I'm gonna,
ready. The public.
I'm going to blow
ready.
Your mind. The CBS Radio Mystery Theater, invented by or created by a man born in like 1910, and with actors mostly born in the 10s to 20s, was not on the cultural forefront.
You know what? I don't think Deep Throat was on the cultural forefront.
Yeah.
But be that as it may.
Yeah. So anyways, then Flossie is like, hey, we should, or Flossie's like, we should leave. And Jack points out that the house is inescapable. And Flossie, because he's locked all the doors and the windows are unbreakable, which is not true, as we'll later find out. But Flossie suggests that she could get the key. And Jack is tempted, but ultimately decides to stay with his wife, who, I mean, is, as far as we can tell, a horrible person who has no affection for him. Aside from that she occasionally gets jealous. And then Milo, but at this point, Nils overhears and says that they have to wait to leave because the plague is going to be most dangerous in the next few days. And that Jack is one of the handful of people the world needs. And they're kind of weirded out by this, but I can't tell if they either should just brush it off entirely as him being crazy, or like be extremely weirded out by him apparently having detailed knowledge of epidemiology and a desire to determine who lives and dies. But they strike this weird middle ground where they're just like, dude, that was weird, and then move on, and I don't get it.
Well, it's kind of a compliment. I mean, you kind of want to tell the guy, you know, oh, how sweet. It's like when my sons tell me something kind of ridiculous that they mean as kind of a good thing. Like, oh, thanks, buddy.
You're just like, oh, hey, Nils, you're one of the few people the world needs, too.
Yeah, right? You just say it right back.
Yeah.
Well, the world needs you, too, man.
Conspicuously, he does not say the world needs Flossie.
Yeah.
So, anyways, Then Milo comes in and says he's going to throw a masquerade party to raise their spirits. And I mean, at this point, two of the people in the house hate him. And one of the people in the house is actively threatening him. But he's like, nah, we need to get kind of drunk around each other and cut loose. And there's a lot of argument about this. Flossie and Jack are both utterly disgusted by the idea. And Doreen says, well, at least he's trying something and let's move on. And then Nils goes off on a long sort of monologue about how Milo has lost his humanity when he made his money and that the masquerade will be the last thing that he ever does. And then he calls on God to smite Milo and says that Milo wants revenge and that Milo has made himself ugly and drifted from God. And Milo responds to this by continuing to try to invite Nils to the masquerade and indeed employ him, which... I don't know about you, but if one of my employees says that God is going to kill me, I'm probably going to make him leave.
I don't know. It depends on what they do. Like, I remember growing up, my folks had this exterminator. He was like this the bug guy who would come around and spare house like every once in a while. And he was this weird evangelical guy who wanted to write these very violent songs about salvation. And I don't know. They kind of kept him around. I grew up in the rural South, so.
Okay, so that wasn't quite as out of character. Also, the guy wasn't talking like he personally knew God and was going to, like, whisper in his ear to kill you, I guess.
Not to kill us, but maybe other people. Anyway.
Yeah, so anyways, that's our next axe break. And then on the introduction, E.G. Marshall says that he thinks we're good friends and that he at least has enjoyed our time together. And, you know, I want to say back at you, E.G. You're a hell of a host and you were a great actor.
It was a really sweet moment. Did he do that in every episode?
Nah, he's kind of an unusual horror host because he's not especially sinister. And he's also not like...
Friendly.
Yeah, and he's not really creepy. He's not threatening the audience. He's just like this weird old guy where you go to his house and he tells you a strange story.
My grandpa.
Yeah. Huh. If your grandpa, you know, would occasionally open up his brain and start telling you about women enjoying being raped or something, which is a subtext on a surprising number of these.
Ay, ay, ay.
The weird thing is that the ones I've heard that were like that were all written by... Elspeth Eric, who is a woman. So I joke on a previous episode that I think we can kind of guess the sort of stuff she was into in the bedroom, but it is kind of weird just how often she would return to that well.
That is, strange. All right, anyway, so we get an act break. Grandpa tells us he loves us, and we're back.
Yeah. So then, for some reason, again, Milo is still determined to have this party. Doreen dresses as Marie Antoinette because, as I have in my notes, subtext is for cowards. And Jack dresses up in some weird domino costume. Doreen sort of tries to talk Jack into being nicer to his husband or to her father, and there's a little bit of, like, not quite tenderness between them, but something. One sec. Sorry.
Not hatred.
Yeah. Not just Doreen being a horrible person and Jack oozing disgust for her, which is kind of their normal dynamic. But she does complain that Jack won't shut up about pollution and wonders why they can't just be happy for a little bit. Which, I don't know, man. I guess I'm not... When I first heard this, I was probably less sympathetic, but having gone through the quarantine, I guess I am a little more sympathetic to her idea that... I mean, it's not like they can help anyone anyways, so...
Right.
I mean, I guess having too good of a time, it gets kind of obscene. But on the other hand, what good does making yourself feel miserable do? I don't know.
Yeah, it's that's where it gets into the weird moralistic thing, like the puritanical, you know, how dare you kind of thing, which I think was lurking back there in the short story in the first place. But it's really amplified in this. And they go out of their way to make Milo just a horrible person. You know?
Yeah. And then we cut to Flossie and Milo, and this is, I think, the only time we see them interacting together alone. And Flossie asks how Milo can still be happy when all this is happening. And Milo said essentially that he makes himself be happy because otherwise he'd be terrified. So he's just sort of in deep, deep denial. Right. And then Doreen and Jack come down, and Doreen makes sure to give Flossie shit for wearing white because they really want to drive home that Doreen is terrible.
Right.
Which, considering the twist, is or one of the things that's coming up is a little bit weird. And then Nils comes down, and Nils is dressed in a blood red suit, red shirt, red cape. He doesn't have the creepy, or he's wearing a red mask, but it's just a red mask. I believe in the short story, it's literally a mask that's done up to look like a plague victim, which is significantly better. This guy, he's just, you know, hey, you know, I'm all red, like an asshole.
More or less. But then my favorite part comes when they confront him and they take the mask off.
Yeah, and he's like, psych, I'm the Red Death, idiot. This wasn't even a mask. I just got a skull for a face. Stupid.
Yeah, so that was one of those hammy moments where they're like, his face, it came off. It's in my hands.
And I want to dwell on this twist a little bit, because what they should have done, obviously, is have the guy just show up completely unannounced at the party or be a late addition somehow, you know, like one of Milo's business associates or something. I get why they want to have, like, someone be the Red Death, but to have a character we've known all along who was married, who whose wife died of him, apparently? I don't know how that works. Who got a bunch of I mean, this story appears to imply that the Red Death at one point got a prostate exam, you know?
Right. He had a ritual life, the doctor's finger up his asshole. It's you know...
It's... The Red Death was bringing these people coffee.
He made them pie. Now, this is where I have to wonder about, like, who his wife was, right? So, who marries the Red Death?
I mean, was his wife also the an anthropomorphized representation of something, or was she just some woman? And also,
what if she was the Red, and she got into the organic cooking and it killed her? It was too nutritious.
And also, why did they decide to make the Red Death 6'5" and hot?
I don't know, man. If you're gonna have the embodiment of mortality, like, why not? Right?
I mean, I would think generally you do like an old man or someone who looks frail or something, or a it just hot death. I've never seen it done before.
Hot death.
I mean, okay, you know what? I take that back. Death in Darksiders 2 is kind of hot.
Okay, all right.
I mean, he's got a weird face, but he's pretty jacked, and he's got kind of a way with a one-liner. I bet if I looked online, I could find hentai or something of him. But aside from that, I'm definitely, if you're designing a character who is, you know, the embodiment of a plague, this is not what you would do.
It's a weird way to go. Huh.
Yeah. So,
all right, so anyway, he kills them all.
Well, no, that would just be if they were following the fucking story. But instead, they do something even weirder. Which,
yes, they do.
He's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to do some saw shit right now. So he gives Milo a choice and says, hey, I'm going to kill either you or your daughter. You get to pick. And Jack and Flossie are like, hey, what are you going to do with us? And he's like, don't even trip, guys. You're fine. Jack, the world needs you, and Flossie, you're a nobody, and the world maybe needs a nobody, so you guys wait a couple of days and go out and save the world with organic farming. It's fine. And that's another moment I really liked Flossie, you know, her just saying, I don't understand why I've been chosen for this, I am unremarkable, was pretty cool to me. But then Doreen starts complaining about how stupid it is that she doesn't have a say. And the Red Death is like, whatever, man. I don't care. So Milo refuses to choose initially because he's scared. Doreen says is like almost destroyed by seeing her father scared because she says she's never seen him before. So she volunteers herself. And then Milo's like, she chose herself. That's fine. This is awesome. I choose her too. Like, I have in my notes, like a punk ass dick. And then the Red Death is like, psych, I gave you a choice and you chose wrong again. So, you're going to die. And he dies. And then Nils is like, I hope you go to hell, which, I mean, does he control that? I don't know what the sitch is.
Is he supernatural or just preternatural, you know?
I mean, yeah. I mean, can't he like literally say, hey God, that guy was a dick to me, so send him to hell? And then Milo, as he's dying, throws himself through the window and dies next to Magda, which really kind of makes you wonder why they said that the windows were unbreakable. And Nils disappears, and Jack notes that maybe are some people left alive, and they trudge out to build another better world, and I guess also deal with the fact that the love triangle never got resolved.
Why not?
Yeah, so I will say I bagged on this quite a bit because the decision to eliminate half of the reason people like the story, which is the elaborate description of the rooms. I guess I understand why you do that for the radio, because, 10 minutes of someone describing rooms would not be good radio. But still, why bother adapting the story if you're not going to do the thing the story does? And then the twist that the Red Death has been there all along are both weird. However, I do think that if you were trying to adapt it as science fiction, is at least a very weird idea, and I'm kind of bummed it didn't work out and they didn't do more than it. And also having it be an ecological apocalypse story is interesting because, I mean, it's more resonant, and especially if you're living in a world where presumably you've conquered most diseases, hopefully, or will conquer them soon, and they're no longer like this apocalyptic threat, I guess environmental collapse would be the next move.
See, that's what I mean, is that I can see this story being kind of adaptable, like permeable in this weird way. Like, you would have to flesh it out, and you would have to find the sort of cause du jour in order to moralize it, because there is a moralizing underneath there, right? It's a kind of puritanical moralizing, but this is such a strange way to flesh it out. I could even see this working in the circumstances that they've got it, right? A rich industrialist holds himself up with his cronies in his, estate somewhere, and then, throws a big, lavish, hedonistic ball in the face of the misery around them, and, somehow the plague gets in there and kills them all. I can see it sort of working like that. And I can see the moves that they're making to make Milo indefensible and, the things like that. Not just pulling the gun on everybody, but also, killing Magda, sending the pilot away. I see what they're going for. It just, it's so absurd, it doesn't really work. But that's what I find fascinating, and that's why I said you might want to listen to it. Because it is so bizarre.
Yeah, and I mean, even if you fixed the fact that Nils is the Red Death, I think this probably would still be kind of boring because the interpersonal stuff isn't very interesting, and the organic farming as the solution to all our problems seems hopelessly naive to us now.
Right.
But with that there, it's kind of a disaster a little bit.
It's absolutely a disaster. But that's what makes it kind of interesting as far as an adaptation goes, Like, why would you make that choice to do that? But I guess you just explained it. They were writing this one in the morning to be recorded around noon. And then
wouldn't write them
1:45, they had to write the next one.
Well, they wouldn't write, it would be like spec scripts, essentially. It wasn't like they were churning out the script in the morning, too.
Okay, gotcha.
But still, I mean, it's a $350 script, so the only way you really are going to make that worth your while is volume, essentially.
Right. No, so I get it. I get it. It's weird padding and all kinds of things, but I guess it's sort of like you're saying, under those circumstances, weird shit begins to bleed through. Like, you suddenly get a glimpse into conscious or subconscious expectation. And that's kind of fascinating in and of itself,
Yeah, I don't know. No one's probably ever going to write this, but there is sort of a fascinating story you could tell with this about sort of not quite the greatest generation, but a combination of the greatest generation, the silent generation, and whatever the generation before the greatest generation was, sort of trying to deal with the social change upheavals of like the 70s through this medium, because it is like kind of an x-ray of their psyche, essentially.
So, and to try to understand now through the lens, not, or to try to understand the present through the lens of the language and creative output, right? For lack of a better word, or the mass media output of like 30 or 40 or 50 years, is this weird sort of almost postmodern circling back on itself.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the headiest thing that I can say tonight.
Yeah. So anyways, we've talked for a bit over an hour. So I'm going to propose we do recommendations and cautions and hop on off. Fair enough?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, so... recommendations? So, Claude, I don't read much. Mostly a podcast man these days and a digging around on Twitter man. But I knew you were coming on the podcast. You're a very literate man. So I was going to have to find something to impress you. So I have found a... I would even call it a classic of literature. And I've read it, and I'm now going to recommend it. I am, of course, referring to Hell's Reach, book two of the Space Marines Battle Series by Aaron Dembski Bowden. It concerns the efforts of Reclusiarch Grimaldus to hold the city of Hell's Reach during the Third War, the Orc invasion of the Third War for Armageddon. I enjoyed it very much, partially because it has a great deal that deals with the Legio Titanica and the Adeptus Mechanicus, which I like. I was especially taken with the fact that an Ordinatus shows up. There is also a character named Princeps Zara, who... I mean, I don't want to get too personal, but she is the most beautiful woman I've ever heard described in literature, and I was so happy to get to spend a little bit of time with her. I also found it fascinating because in a lot of stories like this, the impetus is to make it so that the main character is the only competent one, and they are fighting against a corrupt system and trying to save people in spite of themselves. And in this story, basically, everyone is good at their jobs and sort of trying for the same end and actually doing it fairly competently. And I also found the main character quite interesting because he does not, he's a space marine, so he's supposed to be, you know, I'm this genetically engineered super soldier, I am perfectly adapted for battle. And he's a Black Templar, so he's supposed to long for war, but he absolutely does not want this assignment. And he spends the entire book kind of being an asshole to the humans he serves with, to the point where one of the humans meets a salamander, which is, you know, the space marine chapter that's, of course, most friendly to man. And he's like, why couldn't you have been defending us instead of these Black Templar pricks? I hate them so much. But by the end of the book, Grimaldus has realized that the power the Space Marines can have is a symbol, and he's become a good deal more tolerant of human weakness and failing. So it's kind of the story of, like, a man learning to be a bro, which I quite like. Huh. So, yeah. And the other weird thing is that Warhammer 40K is a very, very silly, like, fictional universe, because it's a fictional universe where 7 or 8 foot tall genetically engineered immortal super soldiers spend all their time fighting orcs with chainsaws. But this book, I think it's a little bit aware of the silliness of the universe because it, like, focuses in on the cool part and ignores some of the sillier parts. The orcs never shout WOG, for instance, which is, of course, their battle cry. And it never even says the name of the orc warlord, Gazkul Mag-Urak Thraka, instead choosing to call him the great enemy constantly. But on the but it never, like, winks at the silliness either. It's just like, no, here's the cool parts of Warhammer universe, and I'm going to revel in those cool parts. And it is so good, and I really recommend it to everyone here. You know what? As for caution, I have recently come to the conclusion that World of Warcraft is incredibly boring, and I have wasted a great deal of my life on it, and I regret that now. The fact that Blizzard apparently spent most of the time I was playing World of Warcraft sexually having the most hostile environment imaginable to women, and cultivating that with something of a passion doesn't help, but the game itself also sucks. So maybe try to find something else to do with your lives. I know I am. Plot?
All right. Sounds good. You know, along those lines, kind of, I would recommend...
No, it's not. Stop lying.
If we're looking for book recommendations, and this might be one...
You're like, what does this have in common with the Big Lord said? Oh, they're both books.
That's the only thing. No, there's actually something that I think you really might dig. Have you ever read the manuscript found in Saragossa?
Shit, I know that's like a Machin novel or something weird, right? Like manuscript found in the Sargasso Sea.
Kind of, yeah. It's by this weird Polish guy from the 19th century named Jan Potocki, and it's kind of like the Thousand and One Nights, and that it's these intersecting stories that sort of like loop into each other, and they go like further and further and further and further and further down, like, you know, the story within this story within this story within this story within this story. But it's all variation and permutation, with this dude basically riding through, like, repetitively, you come back to the scene of this guy riding through this valley in Spain, where he passes by, you know, two hunged corpses, or he falls asleep under there, and then there are these beautiful women that come to him, and then he wakes up, and then he's in an underground cave, and then he's here, then he's there. It's really weird. It's really bizarre, but it's sort of like this fascinating series of basically interlocking gothic tales. So it seemed like something, you know, knowing what I know of you, it seemed like something you really might get into, or something that you might find extraordinarily tedious. But at least give the first five tales or so a read, because they're really pretty short, and they're very evocative and just strange, and it kind of draws you in with the Byzantine nature of it. It's pretty groovy. And things to avoid, I'd say my neighbor across the street. If you can avoid my neighbor from across the street, it might be for the best. I have this really, I hate grass. I think I was talking about mowing the grass last time. And there's a yellow jacket nest in the middle of my yard that I have to mow around, because otherwise I get stung. And we have too much yard. This was literally the only place in this place that was available for rent, so we kind of had to take it. But it's got this yard that's immense, and it's just nasty grass that I have to cut every 2 weeks. And I bought this used, like, really crappy, you know, push mower. And it takes me literally 2 hours to cut the grass. And so I guess it was last weekend, we knew that there was this big torrential thunderstorm coming, because we're in the middle of hurricane season. And so I had one evening to get out there, spend 2 hours, my wife was watching the kids, and I could cut the grass. And I noticed my neighbor, like, across the street, he, not like direct neighbor, but the across the street neighbor, he was out there on his riding mower, and it's not just one of those regular riding mowers that, you know, like a King of the Hill riding mower. It's one of the full-on, I do this for a living riding mowers, with the two handles on the side to guide it and control it and everything like that. He was out there for 2 hours as well, and he was on a riding mower, and he has less grass to cut than I do. And I noticed that for about 15 minutes, he was just going in a circle around a tree. I don't know, it was sinister behavior, that's all I'm saying. So avoid my across the street neighbor, especially when he's mowing the grass, because I don't know what he's gonna do.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like a Shirley Jackson novel situation might be happening over there.
Yeah, it's really bizarre, it's really weird, and he's always out there.
Okay,
just stay away from him.
Fair enough. I got, as long as we're doing like rental stories, I'm going to give another rare double recommendation, which is, if you're ever in Albuquerque, if you get a chance to rent from my old landlord, I'm not going to tell you her name, so this is going to be a fun like challenge for you. I would recommend that you do. She did all the yard work for us, and she, her husband came over and was trying to fix a swamp cooler, and he was trying to fix the one in our backyard, which was not the one that was actually like goofing up, so I had the dog in the backyard. And for some reason, he elected to go out there, even though my dog was snarling and at him a bunch. So the dog bit him, and they were cool about it and let us keep the dog. So, I mean, all landlords are scum and class enemies and parasites, of course. But that landlord, pretty good. Liked her a lot. Would recommend her.
That's really cool, man. Thanks.
Yeah, that's why I always joke that my dog has a flawless politics, because he attacked a landlord. Anyways, Claude, thank you so much. And I have just discovered that the man who wrote this also adapted a great many other Edgar Allan Poe short stories. So we'll probably do this again pretty soon.
Oh, God. I'm actually looking forward to it, because I kind of want to see what the hell else they do with what else.
I mean, it's not even the one you'd expect. Like, he's done The Telltale Heart, The Cask of Amontillado, But Murders in the Rue Morgue, which I remember that one actually being surprisingly good. But then he's hitting like weirder ones, like Berenice, the one where the dude rips his wife's teeth out.
I know that one. It's like, what?
Yeah. I mean, I don't pretend to know how he's going to adapt Berenice, but maybe it'll be set in like caveman times or something weird.
Holy shit. Yeah. I got to track this one down.
Anyways, thanks so much for your time, Claude. It's always a delight.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man. This was fun.
Bye. If you'd like to write in with a pedantic correction, a suggestion for a future episode, or a question for the mailbag, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is The Machine Stops by Misery Slims. Thanks for listening.